Carrie wants to know, I began, whether you can take off the clothes and, laying them aside, get into others? Do you understand my meaning? Of course I perceive the idea in your mind. The clothes are made into their present form by my will. When I wish them to assume another shape, for example when I am on the earth plane and wish them to resemble my former earth clothes, they do so. I don't take them off and change them as you do on earth. Our clothes do not wear out, of course. They remain as we think them, and if we want to change them we think the change, and there are the new clothes. J. W. Blanche said she saw you picking stars, which were flowers to you. Was this so? HJL. I often pick flowers, and I suppose they looked as bright as stars to her, and she mixed them up with the stars, which she saw with her mortal sight, as distinct from her spiritual sight, with which she sees me. J. W. Do you know who the little red-beaded girl is? HJL. She has just come here, and I happened to see her looking rather lonely, and so began to interest myself in her. She's gone up to the girls' schools here. J. W. Oh, then they don't have co-education. HJL. Not exclusively, though they have it for some children. You see, here like attracts like. J. W. Have you seen many women? HJL. Not many as yet. Later we see more of them. Now I'll go on with my narrative. J. W. Before you do so, tell me, don't the flowers die when you pick them? HJL. Oh no. Why should they? They are forms, and still retain those forms even if picked. They are simply transferred from the plant to my vase. But they do not die in the vase any more than when they are on the plant. J. W. If you pulled them to pieces, would they perish? HJL. We should never do such a thing. We realize that even the flowers have their rights. Nevertheless, the separate pieces would still exist, and would reunite. Now for my narrative. A few days after I had met P, my guide took me to see the passing up to us of a soul from hell, and his guide went with me, and we found it was the officer. I find it hard to make you understand how we got there, but suddenly we were at the edge of hell. We seemed to be on a dry, barren, rocky edge. Behind us were black rocks and hard, stony ground. The ground, which sloped up towards us from behind, in front of us broke off abruptly. Now this terrible precipice was made far more awful by the fact that at its edge all light ceased. The light seemed to become tiny particles of mist, and at the very edge these seemed to pile themselves up into a great wall against the darkness. There was no intermingling of light and dark, as on earth, simply this awful darkness, which seemed as if it were a solid curtain, or even a wall against which the light piled itself up but could not penetrate. My guide spoke, "Go to the uttermost edge of that rocky cliff and stretch out your hand into the darkness." I went to the edge, and as I did so I felt the hand of my guide resting on my shoulder from behind to steady me. My hand went into the darkness and was immediately lost to sight. I could see my arm as far as the part where it entered the darkness, but beyond I could see nothing. Nor could I feel any sensation in the hand, save only at the place where it entered the darkness. It was more than the darkness which can be felt, it was the darkness which destroys feeling. At the part where my arm entered the darkness I felt a narrow band of intense cold, numbing and yet burning. "May I withdraw my arm?" I asked my guide. Yes, I promptly withdrew it, and was really thankful to find it was undamaged. "Why this darkness and cold?" I inquired. My guide replied, "The light of faith does not exist here, and there is also no love of God. As you are now a spirit, you need the spiritual light and warmth, just as on earth you needed physical warmth and light." Slowly the wall of darkness began to sway to and fro. As it advanced towards the light in one place it receded in another, and the light pressed in and out. There was no interpenetration, simply an undulating line instead of a straight one. As this movement grew more and more violent I sprang back from the cliff, fearing that a fold of darkness might engulf me. But my guide said, "Stand firm. The darkness cannot reach us. There is too much faith here." And so it was, for though the folds of darkness several times swept up onto the land on either side of the spot where we were standing, it never engulfed us, and we were able to realize the awful depth of the precipice, which seemed almost unscalable. But the light gave comparatively little illumination. Suddenly out of the darkness beneath us a ball of light began to emerge, and, rapidly mounting, we saw it was a glorious spirit of light. As he rose from the depths the darkness seemed to fall from off him, to use a homely simile, like water from a duck's back. Having climbed over the edge of the cliff onto its top, he lay down and stretched his arm down into the darkness. It vanished up to the shoulder, but gradually he withdrew it, and soon we saw his hand grasped that of another. The newcomer's hand was not bright and shining like his, but dark and dirty, with a pallid, unhealthy tinge. Soon the struggled up beside him, slowly and painfully, a most miserable object. His eyes were covered with a kind of bandage. He fell to the ground beside his guide, who rose to his feet and gently helped him to rise. The newcomer wore a dark grey ragged garment, which was covered with stains, and seemed to have, as it were, patches of darkness still clinging to it. His hands and face were also stained and dirty. "Oh, this terrible light," he moaned. "I can see it even through this bandage." To us it was a very murky light, most like that seen in a London fog. "How foul his clothes are," I said to P. "To us, yes, but if he could see them they would to him appear unwontedly clean," said P. "I expect to you your clothes appear quite clean?" "Yes," I replied. "Well, I can see many stains on them, and I have no doubt to my guide mine also appear foul." I felt very humbled by this remark and remained silent. P. stepped forward and, taking the newcomer by the hand, said, "Welcome. I am happy indeed in being allowed to greet you on your entrance into this new realm." "Is that you, my master?" said the other. "It is indeed good of you to come and welcome me. But this light is terrible. I long for the darkness again." "Oh, that will soon affect you less. This is a friend of mine who has come to welcome and help you," and he signed to me. I took the other hand of the man, whom henceforth I shall call by the name of the officer, by which you already know him. We led him slowly down the slope and then seated ourselves on the ground. Here he told me who he was on earth, which I have repeated to you briefly, and something of his life in hell. The latter I shall not give you now, as he will give it himself in due course. We stayed like this for a long time, it seemed equal to several days, but at length, when he had told us much about himself, his guide spoke. "By telling your evil life and something of what you have suffered, you have made it possible for your eyes to bear the light without the bandage." He then removed it, and the officer sank to the ground and covered his eyes with his hand. My guide then spoke, "We must now return." "What of the officer?" I inquired. "He will follow us, but more slowly. He cannot fly yet, but will have to climb painfully up to us." We then rose in the air, P. and I, in what seemed no time, were back in these now familiar surroundings. I gather from the officer, who arrived a short time later, it seemed like a few days, that he had had to cross a kind of stony desert which mounted up to a range of hills. When he had climbed to the crest of these, he found they sloped down but slightly towards a plain, and that plain was where we dwell. While crossing this plain, he was haunted by the most awful visions of his former evil life, similar to, but far more intense and terrible than, those I saw and suffered from. His guide came to him but rarely, and though to us we seemed to have parted from him but a few days, as it were, to him it seemed years. The visions haunt him even as they do me, but far more fiercely, and as yet they are still in the nightmare state which I described as assailing me at first. They have not yet sorted themselves out, as they did for me. He has, therefore, of course not yet started going to school. In short, he is only just in our realm. This now enables you to understand the spiritual condition of the three persons who are trying to communicate with you from here. I feel that you cannot realize how intense all these experiences are. For example, the awful horror of that darkness I cannot convey to you, and even if I did, you could not convey it to others on earth. It was a horror which seemed to choke and freeze me. It was awful beyond measure. Chapter 16, Guardian Angels. H.J.L. continued. Now, is there any point you wish to raise? J.W. This is the third time I have seen this landscape, but I have never seen your guide. Is he never with you when I am here? H.J.L. Not always, but he is here at times. He is now. Oh, my guide and friend, open his eyes still wider. Then something was placed over my eyes for a moment, and I could see nothing. The something was removed, and, behold, I could see more clearly. Behind H.L. stood a great spirit form made of light. His robes kept changing color and seemed to run through all the colors of the rainbow. He was far taller than H.J.L., and large in proportion, being perfectly made. He was at least three times as large as H.J.L., and his face was more beautiful than any Greek sculpture. Strong, noble, well-cut features, there was nothing feminine about it. Yet it was a kind, as well as a strong face. It was a face that was neither old nor young, nor did it seem to have color, for example brown hair, as we understand it, but rather to be a figure of golden light. Yet there was both hair on the head and beard, majestic and flowing. No words can describe the majesty and beauty of this being. I can quite understand whence the ancients drew their inspirations for their gods. Then I thought, this is doubtless an angel, and I looked instinctively for his wings, but he had none. Have I not a guide? I inquired. Like the tones of a great bell rang out the word behold. Then I saw that behind me was another great spirit of light. Now, though in general aspect he resembled the guardian angel of H.J.L., I perceived that I knew this spirit. His face seemed hauntingly familiar, yet it was an extraordinarily mobile face, the same, yet ever changing, never for an instant exactly the same, and yet always retaining certain characteristics. It was different too, markedly, from the guide of H.J.L. I knew this being of light. I felt almost as if I had seen him in my dreams, but that the dreams had been forgotten. He, too, had a beard, but not so long as that of H.J.L.'s guide, and, like him, was of far more than human size. Light seemed to emanate from his whole body. He raised his hand, and that same glorious bell-like voice spoke. Enough. It is not well that you should see more. Again the hand, for so I now perceived it to be, was placed over my eyes, and when it was removed I could see only H.J.L. and the landscape. We must part now, he said, and, rising, floated away from me. I stood looking at the beautiful landscape, lost in contemplation. Gradually I became aware of a sensation of something pulling me. In spite of strong resistance on my part, I felt myself drawn backwards as if by an invisible cord. Step by step I seemed to move uphill and away from the stream, then there was darkness. When I next became conscious, I was back in my house. Chapter 17, Blanche sees H.J.L. and Molly. Clairvoyant appearance of H.J.L. to Blanche and J.W. At 6 p.m., March 3rd. While at tea, Blanche suddenly said, "Why, there's Grandad. Show him to me," I said. "I can't see him." She went to the dining room window, the one looking east, and said, "I shan't show him to you, or he'll go away." While we were talking, I began to perceive something some distance away, and soon saw H.J.L. I asked Blanche what she saw, as I saw him. She said he was in a room typing. That rosy dawn, the little girl, was playing on the floor. Now she's going out at the door carrying her doll. Why, there's a brown poodle with her. Yes, I said, it's Molly. Don't you recognize her? Yes, it's Molly, mother, she cried. The vision grew faint and faded away. I saw exactly the same as she did, but H.J.L. had his back towards me, and was certainly doing something with his hands, but I don't think it was typewriting. The child had seen her other grandfather typing, and not knowing what H.J.L. was doing, interpreted his action by that of my father's. This vision was different from other appearances to me of H. J. L. It was at a distance, and appeared, as she said, to be in the sky. All others have been near to me. Only on Monday I had said to C. W., I wish I could be present next time B. says she sees anything. I think this was the answer. Chapter 18, Men Are Self-Judged, Trance Conversation with H. J. L. During night of March 9th, I found myself in a forest glade, and seated beside me was H. J. L. He said, I think it would be as well at this point to clear up once and for all the exact relationship of faith and works. Faith must be shown forth in works. If a man really believes the teaching of Christ, for example, he will strive to follow it out in his life. A man who says with his lips that he believes that teaching and then goes on day by day breaking all the moral laws that Christianity teaches is simply a humbug. I do not mean by this the man who, though he strives, often gives way to temptation. For that man there is the realm which I call the realm of belief without acts, but I do mean the hundreds of professing Christians who make no attempt to carry out Christ's teaching. The men who go to church regularly on Sunday and spend the week in cheating and lying and so forth. These go to hell, they have not believed, and their evil life proves it. J. W. Wherein, then, does this differ from being judged solely by our acts? H. J. L. Firstly, the word judged is misused. It implies that someone outside ourselves judges us. This is not so, we stand self-condemned. Our spirit cannot rise to higher realms than those for which it has fitted itself. There is no necessity to enforce any law, for the law is self-acting. I shall make this point plain if I answer your question. The difference lies in this. Suppose a complete materialist, one who neither believes in God nor in a future life, and one who does his best to dissuade others from believing in these essentials. This man may be a real philanthropist, actuated by a noble desire to promote the material well-being of his fellow men. This man dies. How can he come even to the realm of half-belief? His spiritual body has never been developed. He could not bear the light. He must develop this spiritual body and lose the materialistic ideas before he can possibly come to us. No hard judge dooms him to hell. He goes there naturally of his own accord. Like attracts like. His lack of faith bars him out from all realms in which faith is an essential element of existence. He goes therefore to Division 5 of Hell, but, though there was no love of God, there was of his fellow men, and this will save him from sinking lower and help him to desire to rise. Once the desire to progress in spiritual matters does appear, that progress will probably be sure and continuous, but unfortunately the materialistic mind remains materialistic after death. Often it denies that it is dead, and considers its psychic or its spiritual body to be a physical body, so that it is still alive on earth. Even when it realizes it has passed through death, it may still deny there is a God and refuse to listen to any who could teach it. Thus it will remain in hell. Nevertheless, the number of good materialists is far smaller than most people would suppose. Even on earth, many a man who outwardly poses as a materialist in his heart of hearts really believes and comes to our realm. Further, after death such a man usually remains for a considerable time in his psychic body, and the conditions of life on that plane, that is the astral, soon convinces most men of some at least of the most elementary spiritual truths. While on the subject of the psychic body, let me draw your attention to the fact that you have misunderstood the seventh plane in my chart. You have understood it as the earth on which you are now living. It is really the earth plane, and can be separated broadly into the division of the incarnate and of the discarnate spirits. The former are of course yourselves, the latter the earth-bound, and also a crowd of other organisms, such as elementals, empty psychic bodies, and so forth. The dead man first passes through this stage, and only when he has dropped his psychic body can his spiritual body enter the sixth plane, even hell. I was but a brief space in it, and must have dropped my psychic body almost before I realized I had one. I believe it took place as soon as the bedroom gave way to this beautiful scenery. The officer, however, spent a long time in the psychic body, and has a very clear recollection of dropping it. I hope I have now made plain the relation between faith and conduct. Now go to sleep." And, standing in front of me, J.W., he made a number of passes, and I sank into oblivion. Chapter 19, The School for the Regenerate in Hell. Transvision, Monday, March 16, 1914. I seemed to be rushing through space at a tremendous speed, and then I found myself standing beside H.J.L. We were standing on a hillside, and below me, among the trees, I saw the towers and roof of a large building. It had quads and open grounds round it like a college. "What is that building?" I asked. "That is the college in which I at present live. It is the form of the building which was Queen's, Oxford, before the present classical building was put up." J. W. "Can I go and look over it?" H. J. L. "Perhaps at another time, but not now. I wish to tell you about my experiences in the schools of hell. I was first taken to the schools of those who have progressed from the lower depths of hell. You remember my chart, A. W.?" "Yes, I remember there were two divisions of the topmost division, the one you mention and the babes' school. I have seen a vision of the latter." H. J. L. "Well, I went first to the other schools, but have since been to the babes' school. My guide said, 'It is well that you should go to see the work in the schools.' Next moment we were standing on the bare rocky ground, as real to us as the earth world is to you. Again before us rose that terrible wall of darkness, but there was this difference, that at one place a rough track seemed to be worn away which led into the darkness. 'How was it,' I inquired, 'that the officer did not come out by this route? It is far easier than the way by which he emerged.' 'The road into hell is always easy,' my guide replied. 'The road out of hell is always hard. This you should surely know. Shall we have to climb up that awful precipice?' 'No, we go down into hell, but do not become part of hell. Hell is a state, not a place, and thus, though we perceive others in that state, and perceive also the evil atmosphere they draw around them, we do not ourselves partake of that state. In this world, where thoughts and forms are as real as the physical is on the earth, we can only feel the evil effects of hell by becoming part of it. That, unfortunately, is possible. Many a soul who has come here with the desire to do good has fallen and become a part of hell, just as on earth men who go to work among the fallen, alas, may be led astray by those whom they come to save. If that should happen to you, then you would be unable to return by this road, and would have to climb up the precipice." I became afraid and cried, "Don't go. Let me not risk it. I am safe where I am." But he answered, "Here there is no standing still. You must progress either upwards or downwards, and this journey must be taken. But fear not, am I not with you? Moreover, spirits do not fall in this division of hell. Here the worst is past. It is when they go down to the lower divisions of hell that the danger arises." Thus encouraged, we began to descend the path, and the dread darkness closed over us. For a moment I felt appalled, but the firm grip of my guide's hand gave me strength and encouragement. Then I began to perceive that from him, and to a lesser extent from me, there flowed out a kind of light which enabled us to proceed along the path, though we were unable to see much on either side at any distance. Suddenly we were aware of a great building set right across our path, and we found that the road we were walking upon ran under a doorway into it. There was no way round it, for on either side I found the walls of rock towered up and were absolutely unscalable. "What is this place?" I inquired. "Enter and see," replied my guide. We entered the archway, and it seemed as if our presence was already known, for at once a door opened and we passed into a covered courtyard. What a dazzling light! After the awful darkness through which we had passed, I felt dazed for a moment, but soon I was able to realize everything. Around me were tall buildings on four sides, rather like a great college quad, except that it was much higher and there was a roof instead of open sky. There appeared to be several stories, for there were several rows of windows, and from every one of these a soft light shone. Some light, too, seemed to come from the building itself, I mean from its very walls. Then I noticed a spirit standing by the door. I knew at once that he was of the same nature as I myself, though more advanced. I mean he was not like my guide who is far above me. I therefore inquired of him, "What is this building?" He replied, "It is a house of refuge, a school and a guardhouse combined. One might call it a missionary clearinghouse. To us come down from the realms above spirits who desire to help the unfortunate beings in hell. Back to us come those messengers of hope who have been down to hell. To us come all those who, having begun to progress, need helping upwards, and, finally, hither come those who need only to be taught, that they may leave hell altogether for the realm above. Besides these duties, we also bar the way, so that none of the inhabitants of hell may attempt to reach the realm above save by the hard path which is ordained for them. The road you have trod is for those beings in that realm who desire to do good in hell, or such as you, who are brought here by their guides to enable them to learn about hell. There are other rest houses scattered along the paths which lead out of hell, to which those who desire to progress may go, but this is the great clearing house, or perhaps I might call it the base of supplies for a large number of these houses of refuge. Have I made myself clear?" "Perfectly, I, H. J. L.," replied, "this house sends out men to relieve those in charge of these houses of rest, and also those missionaries who try to persuade men to come to these houses. You further act as the final house of rest for those who are about to attempt the climb up the precipice. But where do the schools come in?" "He. Your first remarks are quite correct, but the latter are not so plain. All in this part have to pass through the school before they can climb the precipice, as otherwise they would be hopelessly lost on reaching the top. But before they can attend the school, they have to be received into the part of the building which is the house of rest. Here they gain spiritual strength, as distinct from spiritual knowledge, just as on earth you often have to nourish the children's bodies before you can teach them, so here we have to build up their spiritual strength, one might almost say their spiritual bodies, before attempting to instruct them. Compare our work with that of some of the societies on earth who rescue waifs and educate them. If you add to that the fact that the children are mostly crippled, and also mentally afflicted, you will get a very fair parallel. At times it is almost heartbreaking, far worse than slumming on earth. Oh, how bitterly we blame those who should have done this kind of work on earth. A man is much harder to convert here. Often after a man's spiritual strength has been developed, we find he is not yet ready to acquire spiritual knowledge in the school. He sometimes runs away, and is only brought back after much search and labor. Often, alas, he sinks back for a time into his old ways, and returns to one of the lower divisions of hell. Others we have to send out on journeys, and employ them in various ways till they are ready to learn. H. J. L. "May I go into the house of rest and see what it is like for myself?" I inquired. My guide replied, instead of the man at the door, "Not yet. But you shall at another time. We will now enter the school. You will find it more in consonance with your previous knowledge, as you went to the secondary school in the realm above. The house of rest would be so unlike anything of which you are as yet aware that you would miss many things which would be of value. After seeing these schools, and also those for the babes, you will be able to appreciate things more when you come to visit the house of rest." We passed through a late perpendicular archway, and, as we did so, I realized that the place was a castle as much as a college. Indeed, I found that there were no external windows at all, for these would have admitted only darkness, which is here more than the absence of light, being in itself a tangible thing. The only window was one which served as a light to guide the wanderers outside to this harbor of refuge. The way this light was trimmed will astonish you. The room into which it opened was the private chapel of the men and women, for there were women here, who ministered in this place. It was distinct from the chapel for the school or the one for the house of rest. This window was behind the altar, and on earth would have been called the east window. It had, however, no stained, but merely white transparent glass. Before this altar the service of the Holy Communion was always being offered up. No sooner was one service ended than a new priest began a new service, and a fresh body of worshippers took up the responses. Thus ever, There goes our prayer for the salvation of those in hell. Out of the east window, no big one, streams out the light of faith generated by this ceaseless service of prayer and intercession.